This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. Today on the show, Kristen Lalonde and Thomas Malik from the Secret Stacks podcast are here to give you their top 10 lists of the best graphic novels of 2015. You can check them out at secretstacks.com or subscribe to their podcast via iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Or you can find them on Twitter at Secret Stacks for the show, or at Library Tom for Thomas, or at Shiny Info for Kristen. Hope you enjoy.
This is Thomas Malik, and welcome to Jackass. I'm here with my co-host, Kay Dizzle.
Hey, whoa, Thomas.
What's going on?
You do know we're doing a Circulating Ideas episode, right?
No, we're doing Jackass. I brought a GoPro, and we're about to jump into a deep Brazilian cave. And
No. We're doing a Top 10 Comics 2015 for Circulating Ideas. We run a podcast together, Secret Stacks. It's about comics and libraries.
Oh. So we're still just Thomas Malik and Kristen Lalonde right now.
Yeah.
Oh, well, let me straighten my tie and get my cufflinks back on so I can get classy.
Yeah. Sorry, okay. we can do the Jackass one when next week, but we gotta do this for Steve.
Arguably all of my podcast episodes are Jackass. That's a different story.
And all of our podcast episodes are for Steve. So, in one way or another.
He seemed miffed when we did an episode without referencing him. So here's an episode just for him.
I hope he's happy for once in his life.
He got the Marissa episode. That was gold.
It was. So here's more gold. We'll carry this podcast on our shoulders, Steve. Don't worry. But yeah, we're going to be doing our top 10 comics and graphic novel picks for 2015 for everybody. We each have a top 10, and we're going to talk about them and why they're great.
And we're going to try to keep ourselves to 2 minutes per title to give you the quick sell.
Keep it quick, keep it light, keep it fun. Thomas, would you like to start with your first pick?
I would. My first title is CMYK, also called Vertigo CMYK. It's a collection of last year's quarterly anthology that Vertigo put out. The CMYK refers to the four publishing colors, cyan, magenta, yellow, and K for black. And each issue revolves around a different color. Now, the writers and artists for each issue are allowed to freely interpret what this means. So in the black issue, black may refer to the darkness of space. It may refer to an emotion within a person. It may refer to an object in a story that happens to be black. But by and large, when you flip through the blue part, you're going to see tons of blue ink. When you flip through the yellow part, you're going to see tons of yellow ink. And so there's a graphic uniformity, even though there's a huge artistic variety. And there are bright, happier stories. There are darker, melancholy stories. There are some that you could share with a child. There are some that you would keep in an adult collection. And I think that it's just multiple diverse stories. It's going to be hit or miss for each reader. Just based on the sheer wealth of stories, it's going to be several dozen in all. But there's a heck of a lot of talent, and I suspect Vertigo is using these anthologies as kind of a talent farm to see who they like to work with. And so you're going to see a lot of rising stars in this anthology. And even the ones that you don't see, whose names you're not going to see in the years to come, they still did some really good work here. That's why I recommend it.
So my first pick is Step Aside Pops, which came out in September of this year. It's a collection of single comics by Kate Beaton. And if you don't know, Kate Beaton has done a webcomic called Hark a Vagrant for several years. And it's a webcomic, so she's put it on her website. And the subject of this webcomic changes every day, so it's like a single. It's mostly single issue or single comic, single panel. But generally they focus on historical events or characters in literature. Step Aside Pops is a collection of these comics. She also did a Hark a Vagrant collection, I believe it was last year or maybe a couple years. I think it was a few years ago, actually. So this is the newest one, and it does not disappoint. The best thing about Hark a Vagrant, as well as Step Aside Pops, is it's a really great way to learn about history, especially historical events you may not know about. Kay Beaton is Canadian, so she includes a lot of Canadian historical events in there. And most people, in America anyway, are not aware of a lot of Canadian history, so that's nice. And she does a lot of funny little skits with literary characters, especially the Bronte sisters and things like that. And in this one, she has some particularly great features on Wonder Woman and Nancy Drew. And they're really funny.
All right, my second title out the gate is Assassination Classroom. It is about what would seem to be an otherworldly being, this large human-sized, roughly tentacled creature named Koro Sensei, who has threatened to destroy the Earth. He has already punched a hole in the moon to prove his abilities. He is impervious to nearly all human weaponry. He can fly at Mach 20. He is extremely smart and capable. But there's something he'd like to do before he destroys the Earth. He would like to spend 1 year teaching high school. And the world's governments have come together and agreed to grant him a high school, given it's going to be a group of the lowest achievers in a Japanese school called Class E. These are students who are not used to doing well at all, but the world governments have decided they're going to keep this under wraps, that they've made a deal with this creature, and they have offered the students a bounty that if any of them can kill Koro Sensei, they're going to get a massive prize, like tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars. Now, here's the catch, is that Koro Sensei is genuinely invested in these children's education. And he is, in fact, a dedicated and talented teacher. And a lot of the humor that comes from these children of various backgrounds, various size and talents, trying to kill this smiling alien thing, is that he will then turn around and show them a trick for how to do math, or he'll analyze their muscle and bone structure and find out how to make one of them a better pitcher who wants to grow up to be a star baseball player. So you get this balance of the macabre and the sweet. And the manga and the anime, they've both been huge hits. And I just hope that gravy train keeps rolling. Volume 6, I think, was the most recent release. And it's been good times.
My second one is Nimona, which came out in May 2015. It's another webcomic turned graphic novel. It's by Noelle Stevenson. She did Nimona as a webcomic for many years, and so now this is the graphic novel version of the story. Basically, it's a tongue-in-cheek fantasy comic that incorporates some science fiction themes as well. Nimona is a shapeshifter and sidekick to a villain. And the villain's name is Lord Ballister Blackheart. The book and the webcomic often goofs on fantasy tropes and stereotypes, a lot of high fantasy tropes, things like that. And it's very irreverent. The humor is very irreverent. So there's a lot of send-ups of a lot of the high fantasy tropes and some subversion of the genre. It was also nominated for an Eisner Award, and then just recently, as in the past few days, it was a finalist for the National Book Award. So it's very good. It's a lot of fun. And if you said if you like high fantasy, anything of that nature with magic, and you like when there's a subversion of genres, I think you'd really like Nimona.
Cool. I'm going to go in the sci-fi direction with my third pick, which is Descender. This is the story of a child robot named Tim 21 who has woken up on a mining colony set against the backdrop of a much larger galactic community. And he's sort of the focal point of a historic humans versus robots conflict that we don't have all the details of when the story starts. And neither does Tim, but he has strange dreams whenever he's the robotic equivalent of unconscious. And he makes some other robot friends. They make their way out of the mining colony, and he learns he's being hunted down by various factions. He is, in fact, valuable to a lot of people who either want to take him apart or believe him to be a missing key to a larger campaign in those historic human-robot wars. And here are the two things that matter here. You got Dustin Nguyen's gorgeous watercolors, where just every page is a work of art. Even if it's just people talking around a table, it looks great. And then you got Jeff Lemire, who, just like with Trillium and The Underwater Welder and other books before them, he's really good at doing this whole Bambi-ish deer in the headlights character, having to deal with a much bigger, harsher, crueler world, and other characters trying to preserve their innocence, or at least protect them because they have a valuable perspective, or just because of their own tragic backstories. Sweet Tooth, that's another Jeff Lemire classic. And I think Descender comes from that line of stories, and it's the sort of sci-fi where if you want to get sucked into the robotics of it or the galactic setting of it, you can. And if you just want to do the character study, you can. So it's a very accessible sci-fi story with, again, over-the-wall great visuals.
My third pick is Princess Leia, Volume 1, which came out this November. It was a comic series for a while before then, obviously. So some background for anyone who doesn't know. Disney bought Marvel, and then Disney bought the Star Wars franchise. So last year, Marvel started publishing a new set of Star Wars comics. And since it was Marvel and Disney has more money than God, they got some very high caliber Marvel writers and artists to work on these books. And it really paid off, because they're very good. Today, though, I am recommending the Princess Leia comic. It takes place after the events of New Hope, which is episode 4. So I hope I'm not spoiling anything from this movie, but Princess Leia's homeworld, Alderaan, was destroyed by the Death Star. So if you've never watched Star Wars, sorry about that spoiler. But it's been a while, so it's not my fault. The first trade is basically, it's about Princess Leia venturing out, and she, after Alderaan has been destroyed by the Death Star, she's aware that all of the people of Alderaan who exist in the galaxy are in great danger because the Empire is going to retaliate by killing them all. And so Princess Leia decides that it's her job as the new leader of Alderaan, even though Alderaan doesn't exist anymore, that she needs to go collect them and protect them and bring them back to the rebels. Of course, everyone in the Rebel Alliance says, no, you can't leave. Are you insane? You're a princess. You can't go. You're too high valuable. The Empire has a target on your head, obviously. It'd be insane for you to leave. And then Princess Leia goes, too bad, and then takes off and goes and gets into some scrapes, and basically we learn about Princess Leia being a total badass leader and learning how to be a leader along the way. You also get some background, her growing up, learning how to be a leader, what being a leader means, and all those things. And so it's very good. I myself, I don't have a lot of feelings about Star Wars one way or the other. I think it's fine, but I'm not like a Star Wars, super Star Wars person. And I really enjoyed this book quite a bit. It made me care about Star Wars when before I didn't really care too much about it. So I think that's a pretty good, it's a sign of a pretty good story. I was sucked in. So that's my recommendation. Though I did also hear that the other Star Wars books were very good as well. There's the Darth Vader book and Star Wars and Skywalker Strikes is another one. Also good. But today I'm recommending Princess Leia. You can hear recommendations about those other two somewhere else. Possibly our Secret Stacks podcast. Because Thomas recommends one of those.
Yeah, I would put them on an honorable mention list for sure.
Yeah. If we had a top 20.
Top 20.
Those other two would be on there.
Alright, my fourth pick could easily be on last year's top 10 list, and it's Miss Marvel. And if you want a litmus test for whether or not people actually like superhero comics, I think you could use Miss Marvel, Kamala Khan, as your little slip of paper to test them. And if they give you an acidic response about, well, this is just some teenage marketing ploy to get a Muslim American girl and, you know, into the spotlight, and they should have made their own character, and, you know, she's appropriating the previous Miss Marvel, blah, blah, blah. Okay, they don't actually, I don't think those people actually like superhero comics, because this is everything that embodies really good superhero storytelling. I was telling great graphic novels last year about, you know, when volumes 1 and 2 were on the nominating block, and I'm sure they're debating volumes 3 and 4 this year, that Kamala Khan embodies all of the same traits that made Peter Parker so likable in the 60s, insofar as Kamala embodies, in the least fake or superficial or designed by committee way, you know, the modern American teenager. The fact that she's a Muslim just means that, you know, her family and some of the settings within New Jersey, where the story takes place, those are some of the things that will embody her environment, but she is still a fully formed character. The side characters around her, the villains, the way she discovers her powers, the smaller side stories and team-ups, the lead-up into Secret Wars, all of it is done more organically, more self-contained, oddly enough, more artistically consistent than so many other comics out on the stands. And I would absolutely recommend it to all ages, anyone who wants a good story out of Marvel. This is one of their new crown jewels. I cannot recommend it enough.
I agree. Yeah, I agree, Thomas. It's a very good, very good pick. My fourth pick is The Wicked and Divine. And this one's been around for a minute, but I'm specifically recommending Volume 2, Fandemonium, which came out in July of this year. If you're not aware of The Wicked and the Divine as a series, it basically tells a story of a group of gods called the Pantheon who come back to Earth every 90 years to take human form. It's set in 2004, because it started in 2004. And so the gods come back to Earth in 2014, not 2004. Come back to Earth in 2014, and they embody famous musicians. So the story kind of centers around a girl named Laura, who's a fan of the members of the Pantheon as musicians. She's a big fan. She goes to the concerts. She's obsessed with them. And she meets them and gets entangled in their crazy world full of mystery. And the mystery, there is a lot of mystery involved because they're gods. And they have their own rules. And the first book, it's mostly about they have to hide the fact that they're gods, obviously, from people. And one of the gods, Lucifer, lets it be known on national TV that they're gods and they have powers and they can kill people and breaks the rules. Everything goes crazy. Volume 2 delves more into the mystery behind Laura gaining powers and uncovers a conspiracy against the gods. So there's a lot of fun conspiraciness going on, mysteries. The Wicked and Divine explores themes of worship, both religious and fan worship, and explores a lot of themes about death. I would say people who are really into mythology, religious studies, music, things like that would really get a kick out of The Wicked and Divine. The Pantheon of Gods is a pantheon across tons of religions, and they use a lot of the mythology from those religions in the book. So if you're really into mythology and gods and religions and religious studies, you'd really get a kick out of all that, all those. And obviously, since they embody musicians, if you enjoy reading about music culture and things of that nature, you would really enjoy this as well. So that is The Wicked and Divine.
I think a lot of people would be able to recognize, I believe it's Usher and Florence and the Machine.
Yeah.
You think they got some lookalikes?
Yeah, and Lucifer's definitely a, in my opinion, it's definitely a David Bowie
yes.
impression. Yes. So, you know, say if you're a music fan, and they did the creative team behind Wicked and Divine did Phonogram, which yeah. was a music-themed comic a while back, too. So, you know, it's a common thread with these people. So, if you're a fan of Phonogram, I think you'd like this, too.
Rounding out, I guess you could call it the bottom five if you wanted, but these are in no real order. But this one is probably my first very personal pick. I don't know that this would go on. I would expect to see this on a lot of Universal top 10 lists, but Howard the Duck. The latest version of Howard the Duck started this year, and he's been characterized as sort of a feathered Larry David, in that he's cranky, he doesn't like people, he kind of sees through everyone's facade very quickly. He's not impressed with superheroes. He's not really looking for glory or trying to save the day or anything. He just kind of wants to earn a living, be a private detective, meet interesting people. But otherwise, could do without, you know, most people. And over the course of things, you get little satirical views of other heroes in the Marvel Universe. So if Howard is beamed away by aliens into the prison with Rocket Raccoon, for example, in a brief Guardians crossover, the perspective from Earth is Spider-Man seeing Howard the Duck get shot and then immediately becoming distraught and acting like, no, first is Uncle Ben, and now this! Ah! Which is, that's just one light example. Like, there's plenty of others. And the other great thing about Howard, they've changed the tagline of the series. This will give you a good feel for how the series goes. Back in the 70s, 80s, the tagline for Howard the Duck was "Trapped in a World He Never Made." And that led to a lot of themes of anxiety and existential dread that were at the core of the Howard character. And now what it seems Chip Zdarsky has done is tweaked that line to "Trapped in a World He's Grown Accustomed to." So he's not necessarily apathetic to the world around him, but he's sort of adapted. He's not sweating bullets over his place in the universe. He's just mildly uncomfortable, and it's really funny to watch things rub him the wrong way while he tries to make a living.
I love Howard the Duck. If you didn't include it on your list, Thomas, it would definitely have been on mine. I love Howard. It's so funny. And is it if he crosses paths with so many other Marvel superheroes? So if you read any of the other series, you get a kick out of his interactions. I especially like his interactions with She-Hulk, who's his lawyer, and they share the same apartment, you know, or the same business building. Their offices share the same building. It's just great. It's just all around great. Thoroughly enjoy Howard the Duck.
Yes.
My first and my bottom five, but again, mine are not in a order either, because this is one of my favorite comics in the whole world, Rat Queens. And specifically, I'm talking about Volume 2, The Far-Reaching Tentacles of Nrygoth. That came out in May. If you're not aware of the Rat Queens, they're a group of four lady adventurers of different classes and races who have foul mouths, they drink a lot, and they take no crap. The series relies heavily on the Dungeons & Dragons universe for world building, because all of the characters, like I said, they're different classes and races. We've got, you know, dwarf fighter and a necromancer and etc. So, kind of like Nimona, how they take the fantasy or high fantasy and subvert it and kind of goof on it a little bit. It's like that. They take the genre and they run with it, and it's full of very funny and bawdy jokes. So they're going on adventures. They get into a lot of trouble all the time, but they're saving their specific little town. So if you've ever played Dungeons & Dragons before, you kind of know how the deal goes. You're in a group, there's a problem, you solve it, just like how the Vanilla Ice song goes. Volume 2, we learn more about the backgrounds of the characters. The Rat Queens themselves have, you know, very specific backgrounds about how they got into adventuring. Some of them are slightly tragic. Some of them are, you know, life-affirming, I guess. My favorite one is with Violet, the dwarf fighter. And that might be because whenever I play Dungeons & Dragons, I always play a dwarf. So, you know, I feel a certain affinity for any dwarf characters. And we learn why she doesn't have a beard and how she came across this other amazing dwarf, female dwarf fighter when she was younger that made her really evaluate her life and just like, I'm going to live my life for myself and not for my clan. And it was really good. So, anyone who likes high fantasy, Dungeons & Dragons, strong female characters, and adult swears will enjoy Rat Queens. It's just an all-around, every person I've requested read it has really enjoyed it. As I always try to preface, it is an adult comic. There are adult swears, adult situations, but it's, you know, it's very fun. And there is some violence, but it's cartoony violence. It's not really gruesomely awful violence. So, Rat Queens, pick it up and read it and enjoy it.
On the opposite end of the age appropriateness scale, I've talked to you about a female Marvel character. I've talked to you about an animal Marvel character. And now I'd like to talk to you about a female animal Marvel character, Squirrel Girl. She eats nuts and she kicks butts, and I think that summarizes most of her activities. But as Doreen Green, she is a woman with the proportional speed and strength and acrobatic ability of a squirrel, and she's going after her computer science degree in college, and she keeps running into these wacky Marvel scenarios, like running into Kraven the Hunter and trying to outthink him. She learns about Galactus heading for Earth to consume it and just getting to the moon to cut off Galactus is as much an adventure as the showdown itself. I don't think it's any sort of spoiler to say that Squirrel Girl is among the toughest characters in the Marvel Universe, but in the hands of Ryan North and Erica Henderson, she is also one of the cleverest, one of the most self-aware, along with Tippy Toe, her squirrel sidekick, who's always on her shoulder talking squirrel to her. They kind of cut to the heart of a lot of things in the Marvel Universe, similar to the Howard the Duck series, in that Doreen sometimes will reinterpret or find a new take on a character and try to relate to them in a way that they may not have been seen in other Marvel series. She's also aided by a bunch of collectible Marvel trading cards to bring her up to speed on characters, which seem to be cross-promoted or at least endorsed by Deadpool. I think it's Deadpool's Marvel trading cards. And so he's sort of inserted into each issue as a little one-off joke as he makes his little inside references to different characters. But that's getting beside the point. That Squirrel Girl represents an all-ages title with plenty of clever humor, jokes written in tiny ink in the margins, tons of visual flair, tons of bright colors, and it's got something for everyone. And it sort of completes my Marvel trifecta in the top 10.
I also love Squirrel Girl. It's a lot of fun. Ryan North, who writes it, is just... he's very fun and clever. He writes a webcomic as well, Dinosaur Comics, if you've not read that. But probably one of my favorite things about Squirrel Girl, like you said, she tries to relate to the people who, you know, are trying to take over whatever thing is coming her way. You know, she humanizes them, even if they're not human necessarily, but she just tries to find out what they really want and then works with it, instead of just jumping in and punching them. But
right.
she might
consider, you know, I don't want to have to fight or hurt Kraven the Hunter. What if I just sort of tossed him up and down for infinity? You know, until he just loses his temper and loses his heat and just cools down. Or she might try to talk him into, like, you know, you're supposed to be this huge big game hunter, but you know, have you ever heard of this rare creature? Have you ever heard of, like, you know, this giant deep sea whale that, you know, has barely ever been confirmed to exist? Like, why don't you actually hunt something that would require lots of ability and quit hunting people who happen to be named after animals? But it's one of those things where it's like, well, that's silly, but she's not wrong either.
Right, exactly. It's, you know, it's nice. And if you're talking an all-ages comic, it's a nice thing to tell kids, like, hey, you know, maybe we could try to relate. Someone might seem like they're your enemy, but maybe you could try to relate to them, see what they actually want. And whenever that's always a skill they try to get you to learn in diffusing tense situations. But like, well, are you actually listening to the other person? Maybe you're interpreting it one way and they're interpreting it another way. So this is very, you know, I feel like it's very in that vein. A problem
she hijacks when she hijacks Iron Man's armor, tippy toe adopts one of the Iron Man gloves as a tiny squirrel sized suit of armor, and it's very cute.
It's just a very cute comic all around. My sixth comic is another computer science major, Batgirl, specifically Batgirl of Burnside, which came out June of this year. Little background. Last year, Batgirl was rebooted to focus storylines more that will appeal to younger female readers. So Barbara Gordon moves to Burnside, which is the trendy part of Gotham City. Try to think of like Williamsburg, Brooklyn, etc. And she starts college as a computer science major. So compared to the old Batgirl, it's far less gritty and dark. Those are both things I don't really enjoy in comics, so I was pretty excited about this new reboot where Barbara's basically in charge of taking out the trash in Burnside. So there's crime, various crimes from a lot of very colorful villains in Burnside. She takes care of business. And she's going to college, so we get to follow Barbara around as she navigates the crime in Burnside as Batgirl, and then as she navigates life as a young woman in college, making friends, meeting young gentlemen that she'll go on a date with, all the, and then how they interweave with her being Batgirl. Another great part of Batgirl is the art. Babs Tarr, who does the art for Batgirl, it's just so nice to look at. It's lush and colorful. I just love looking at it. It soothes my eyes looking at it. It's so nice. It's just a very nice looking comic book. It's a treat to look at. And it's wonderful. It's nice to read and it's nice to look at. Like I said, any kind of Bat comic book, usually Bat Family, it's a lot of angst and darkness and we feel sad and we have to, you know, we're taking care of these problems and it's, oh, we're so upset. But Batgirl, Burnside, there's a lot of color and sometimes people smile in it, so that's nice. But, you know, it is a Bat comic, so there is, you know, she does face some problems. It's not just all bubblegum stuff, but it's a lot less gritty, which is nice. So, Batgirl of Burnside. Very nice. I enjoy it.
For my 7th pick, lucky number 7, I'm going to go with one of the luckiest men on the planet in his manga, One Punch Man. This is a series that I would almost get tired of recommending because the digital volumes started coming out last year and then the print volumes have been coming out this year and I can't shut up about it whenever someone asks either in a librarian forum or just people ask me like what new manga are coming out, what would you recommend? I think everyone would get a kick out of One Punch Man. It is such a no-brainer. Even its story is kind of a no-brainer. You think of the archetype of the noble hero who gives his, you know, spends his entire life in training so that he can undo a personal wrong or live up to a certain legacy. Here we have the story of Saitama. He is a man who decided one day he would become a hero for fun, and so he trained really hard by doing 100 squats, 100 sit-ups, 100 push-ups, and running 10 kilometers a day for 3 straight years. And the exertion made him go bald, and now he can win pretty much any fight in one punch. And we use this setup to tear through all kinds of paper-thin action story and superhero tropes. So if he joins a local heroes guild, for instance, then he's going to pass all the physical tests amazingly, but he gets held back during the written test, and he turns out to be one of the lowest-ranked heroes, despite being one of the best in any class. When he takes on a protege, it's this cybernetic warrior named Genos, and Genos presents himself extremely seriously and throws paragraphs of tragic backstory and about artificial intelligence at Saitama. And he's like, just give it to me in 20 words or less. I don't need to know about all this. And oftentimes giant hulking beasts or different villains of a bunch of different stereotypical stripes get in his way. But really the biggest problem to him is, Is that fish sale still available this Saturday? Am I still on time? You know, is there an analog from Attack on Titan in my way? Okay, bam! I've taken it out in a glorious 2-page spread of a punch. Time to go back to my daily errands. It's fantastic. I can't recommend it enough.
My 7th pick is one a lot of people probably have heard about, but I'm still going to recommend it anyway. That'd be Lumberjanes. Definitely one of the best comics out now. Volume 1 and Volume 2 came out in 2015, so that's handy. If you're not aware of Lumberjanes, I will explain. Noelle Stevenson, in addition to doing Nimona, also created the Lumberjanes. The Lumberjanes are kind of a more rough and tumble version of the Girl Scouts. And Lumberjanes, the comics, focuses on 5 girls who are in Lumberjanes. They are Lumberjanes. And they live in the Roanoke cabin together. And they're all best friends and spending their summer at the Lumberjane Scout camp together. All the girls bring different talents to the group, and they're all very supportive of each other. as they encounter ancient mysteries and the surrounding woods. It's a lot of fun. They all work together to work, you know, to tackle any problems that come their way. They do problem solving together. And like I said, they all have different talents that they bring to the table. Lumberjanes, in addition to showcasing these wonderful female friendships, they also showcase great diversity, especially in regard to race, sexuality, and gender. Particularly with the inclusion of a trans character with a Lumberjane named Joe. And it's interesting, we learn she is a trans girl in, I believe, issue 17. Issues 1 and 2, or volumes 1 and 2 of Lumberjanes don't include issue 17. So I guess you would have to know from issue 17 that Joe is trans, but she is. And it's very wonderfully done. It's so nice. You just feel really good when you read it. People, they get along, they support each other. It's a really nice book, and you encounter a lot of strange things. They challenge a lot of gender stereotypes without, you know, saying you have to be this specific kind of girl. Like, this kind of girl is bad. You should be this sort of girl. They challenge gender stereotypes without going that route. The creative team behind Lumberjanes does a really great job of being very inclusive and without, you know, beating you over the head with, this is a very special episode sort of thing. It's a wonderful comic. It's all ages, but it does have adult appeal. At my library, we have a copy in both the adult collection and in J. So it doesn't hurt to have a lot of copies because it's a very popular comic. So Lumberjanes, go and get it. I would say one issue I do have with Lumberjanes is that each volume only has 4 issues. So if you're only reading the trades, it's going to take you a really long time to get through all the stories. But if you have Hoopla, Lumberjanes is on Hoopla. So you can read the single issues there as well.
Hey, Kristen.
Yes.
Can we drop a secret here, courtesy of the Secret Stacks podcast?
Yes, we can. That's the benefit of having us on Steve Thomas's Circulating Ideas.
Well, one of the major frustrations regarding Lumberjanes has been the slow rate of release of each trade that comes out. Because Volume 1 was one of the only things going for like over a year. When really, like, I think up to volume 4's worth of issues are out by now.
Yes.
I think I know the secret on this one. The series was originally planned to just be a very short miniseries. So that's why and then the response to Lumberjanes, the huge fan reaction was so big they decided to continue it. But in terms of Boom Comics' publishing schedule, they weren't ready to start putting together plans for volume 2 and 3 and, you know, getting everything squared away for that. So they were like, okay, we'll keep putting out issues, but now we got to talk about, you know, how many paperbacks are we going to do? Do we want to make a hardback edition? What kind of extras? Blah, 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 blah. And so now they're only just now starting to catch up, and I'm glad they're catching up. But it's such a runaway success. You're absolutely right.
It's really great. I mean, it's going to be on a lot of people's top 10 lists across the board because it's just really wonderful. I feel like it has a lot of appeal for a lot of different people. But the fact that they go out of their way to be so inclusive, it's very nice. It's very refreshing.
It and Squirrel Girl would be best friend read-alikes.
Absolutely.
For certain. My number 8 pick is here to rip your heart out. It is Sunny, which is about a children's home for orphans. And it's gotten up to volume 5 as of this year in the English releases. And by this point in the story, because we've been introduced to each of the children by now, and we've got an idea of what the adult handlers are like and how other children in the neighborhood regard these kids and how what their day-to-day life is. We've gotten all that out of the way now. And even just getting that much information has been a very bittersweet experience with its own tragedies, comedies. But now the other shoe drops. And I think part of this may be due to the publisher who releases Sunny announced that the series will be ending soon. So I think that Tayo Matsumoto, he's closing up some story threads. The children in this orphanage begin experiencing a very unique and unfair scenario respective to each individual, where they're beginning to assert their independence. They're beginning to feel like they can grow out of the orphanage, leave the orphanage, find a new family, return to their old family, escape the orphanage one form or another. But it has not quite dawned on them, or perhaps it's being reaffirmed to them, that there's a reason that they're in this orphanage, even if their parents are alive, or even if there is a guardian who would take them in, or even if they could potentially run away and live on their own, or even if they thought they were lost and their parents did find them. It's just one rip your heart out chapter after another, where I had to read this at a rate of a chapter a day or slower, because every time I reached that page that said end, I would think, I can't. It's like, I need time to digest this. This is some. And then Matsumoto supposedly based a lot of these stories on his experiences growing up with other orphans and growing up in a children's home. And I don't know. I almost just want to have a moment of silence and let that speak for itself, because I don't want to spoil exactly how bad it gets, but it's all rendered beautifully and sensitively, and Matsumoto has nothing but love and respect for these children and the adults in their lives who try to protect them and maybe shield them as a consequence, but are nonetheless trying to do right by them. And these kids have some really tough growing pains ahead of them, and I almost wish the series could just keep on going for another 20 years so we can watch them all become adolescents. But for now, it is a beautifully sad ride.
My eighth pick is Bitch Planet, Volume 1. Volume 1 came out in October. Bitch Planet, it's set in a dystopian version of the world / future, where women are completely subjugated to men in all elements of their life, their appearance, how they act, if they have a job, who supports them, etc. And they're all required to conform to an ideal. And any women who don't conform to that ideal in any kind of way, they're deemed to be non-compliant, and they get sent to a women's prison on another planet, which is colloquially known as Bitch Planet. Basically, it's part subversion of the female prison exploitation movies that were very popular, say, in the 70s, and part Prison Break, as the main goal is to get off of Bitch Planet in some, basically by any means necessary. It's written by Kelly Sue DeConnick. It talks about a lot of, very big issues, just like any good dystopian fiction does. It presents a lot of issues that we deal with, currently in the world of Bitch Planet, especially feminism, racism, sexuality, all those things get covered. We learn about what it means to be non-compliant and through the comic, we question, you know, what parts of the comic are fictionalized and what parts we can see reflected in our own society. It's great for people who like reading science fiction, dystopian things that explore social justice issues, especially feminism. Anyone who's really interested in feminism would probably be interested in this. One of the characters, Penny Roll, I particularly identify with her. She's a large woman. She's seen as being non-compliant because she doesn't fit like a body image. Basically, she doesn't fit the standard for appearance. She's black. She has natural hair. She's fat. And she loves herself. She loves the way she looks. And that's one of the more subversive parts of Bitch Planet. A lot of the stories around, especially if you're fat, is the idea that, you know, the trope that every fat woman has a thin woman inside that she wants to be. And one of the stories talking about Penny Roll's background, she's put in front of a mirror that's supposed to show her what she really wants, what she really wants herself to look like. And everyone's shocked to see that what she really wants to look like is herself, like what she looks like right now. And it just completely, they think the mirror is broken and she's just laughing and laughing and laughing. And that's a really powerful thing. So, you know, it's a very strong comic. It speaks to a lot of people. You know, I really enjoyed it for that reason. And yeah, I would say anyone who's interested in any of those kind of social themes would enjoy Bitch Planet. And, you know, as the name states, it has, you know, adult themes, some swears. There's some shower situations where people are nude. So it is for adults, but it's very good.
My ninth pick. This one, easily 5 stars on my own scale. Recommended for teens, adults, or anyone who remembers being a teen or an adult. Super Mutant Magic Academy by Jillian Tamaki. And I bring up Miss Tamaki because she also worked on This One Summer, which was a huge darling last year, and deservedly so. But some people regarded it as maybe a little bit too precious regarding the lives of pre-adolescent, adolescent girls. Well, Super Mutant Magic Academy is here to take Daria, add in the cast of the X-Men, and send them all to Hogwarts, where they can all have existential crises and fret about their place in the universe and crack wise about social gaffes and the quirkiness of discovering your powers and lots of little one-off non-sequiturs. In which every page is its own little gag strip. And sometimes Tamaki goes for a big laugh. Sometimes she goes for a bit of a head-scratcher or a chin-stroker. And sometimes she just wants to draw something really cool. This comic started out as a webcomic, and it follows that aesthetic through to the end until you get to a slightly longer story arc near the end, where you kind of get the sense that Tamaki had to, you know, she had to put a book together and she had to put a pin in this webcomic so they could have something resembling an ending. But the Super Mutant Magic Academy, it occupies that uncomfortable but funny and swearing space in a lot of young people's lives. And yeah, I've never handed it to someone who didn't hand it back and go, you know, this one part was kind of weird, but then this part had me crying with laughter, and then this part, I wish this part would have gone on because I really connected with these characters, and I think this is just one of the truest high school examinations out there that just happens to use all of the fantasy in the process of getting there.
My ninth pick is kind of a personal pick. I don't know if, like Thomas, I don't know if mine will show up on any top 10 lists. It might, it should. It is Archie versus Predator. And the, that came out in November. Some, give you some background. Periodically, the people at Archie Corp put out special series that pits Archie and the gang against people from other universes and make them do crazy things. Basically, it's just kind of like a one-off, short-run series. Previously, Archie has met the Punisher, and Afterlife with Archie was very popular. Basically, that's where the gang encounters a lot of zombies and witches and other horror stuff with Sabrina, the teenage witch. So in this one, Archie and the gang cross paths with the Predator, the 1980s movie franchise guy with the, who, you know, faced off against Carl Weathers and Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he can go invisible and things. You may remember him. And the story goes, it's going to be spring break. The guys don't have anywhere to go, and Jughead wins a tropical vacation, and they all go onto this tropical island, and little do they know, one of the Predator ships had landed on the island and follows them back to Riverdale. So the story is extremely surreal. Especially since it's played straight the entire way and drawn in the traditional Archie style. So it's written and drawn basically like the traditional Archie, but just so happens the Predator is there and is murdering everybody. No character is safe in this. I'll just put it that way. People are getting knocked off left and right by the Predator. And they don't shy away from really brutal, violent scenes of anyone in the Archie gang getting killed by the Predator. I particularly enjoyed it. I enjoy when there's juxtaposition of the really traditional kind of, not to put down Archie, a little hokey traditional Archie story, and that's contrasted with the extreme violence and absurdity of the Predator following them to Riverdale. And just starting, you know, bumping people off. So I really enjoy it. It makes me laugh when I see it. And Alex DeCampi, who writes it, there's a dark sense of humor throughout the entire thing that's really enjoyable to read. I read Archie a lot when I was, you know, in high school. I'm currently reading the new Archie, but I read the traditional Archie. I used to read all the time. So it's particularly nice for me. So anyone who read Archie and would like to see any of them in mortal danger would really enjoy Archie versus Predator. It's a lot of fun. If you like a lot of violence, there's a lot of violence and it's very absurd. And I would recommend it highly.
Well, Kristen, we are coming up to the home stretch, and we are coming up to what is easily my legitimate number one pick of the year, which shares in common with Archie versus Predator that no one is safe, and I think it could be a perennial pick for its series, Vinland Saga. This is a series that, much like Sunny before it and Ms. Marvel, it was good. It was one of the best in class last year, and I feel it's one of the best in class this year, and I would put it in my top five manga I've ever read easily at this point. It's been coming out in double thick omnibus editions, hardcovers, and this sixth volume, I'm not going to start at the start. Let's just jump in. Volume 6, which came out this year, focuses on, spoiler alert here, jump ahead if you don't want to hear this, Thorfinn's slave life after the events following King Canute He has taken on a new farmhand life, and he and a fellow slave are slowly working their way up to some level of independence. The master of the property is trying to help them get a leg up in life. He's not trying to be a cruel master. And some elements of King Canute's kingdom are starting to seep their way back onto the farm. And not everyone has such a nice deal on the surrounding plantations either. So that eventually Thorfinn is put into an extremely difficult moral quandary where he's unequivocally decided he is not going to go back to the violence that once dominated his life and the series as a whole, I should add. He's decided he's never going to take a life, no matter what. He's done enough of that. But he's put in a situation. This may remind some anime fans of Trigun with the Vash the Stampede character and how he kept trying to find the right way out of a dangerous situation while causing the least harm. And it leads to just one of the most poignant bits of storytelling that this series has found yet, and that's in a series where every volume is one of the most poignant pieces of storytelling that I've found yet. I almost want to say this is a great read-alike for Game of Thrones in the sense that you really grow with these characters and you watch them develop, and they gain some trauma, but they also grow out of some trauma, and they become stronger people and older people and ideally wiser people, but we just have to see what next year holds in store for them. Volume 7 comes out this December, and admittedly, there are tons of graphic novels I did not read this year, but anyone who's read everything that came out would have to concede that Vinland Saga deserves a spot at this table. That is my top 10. How about you, Kristen?
Well, my last pick, it's definitely not the least. It's definitely one of my favorites and one of my most recommended books of 2015. That's Lady Killer. And the trade for that came out in September. Whenever I recommend Lady Killer, I always describe it in the same way. And the concept usually hooks people. It's picture a traditional 1950s housewife who is secretly a hired killer. The story is about Josie Schuler in the 50s who has to maintain the perfect work-life balance. She's being a trained killer and the perfect wife and mother while keeping her family in the dark about her secret trained killer double life. And she's great. She's great at her job. Everything's going great. Basically, until one day, she gets an assignment that she just can't complete. And she then decides that she can't, you know, if there's one job that she can't do, then she's out of the game, basically. So she goes to her boss and says, "I want out." And if anyone knows about how trained killers work, you don't get out of the trained killer business. So now she's the one who's got a target on her head, and she has to find a way to get out of it. So the concept of it is executed, forgive the pun, very well, and it's very entertaining. Like Archie versus Predator, they do not shy away from the violence in this one either. When Josie or any other trained killer in the book has to kill somebody, you see the whole thing. So it's for adults. It's very for adults in that way. There is the graphic violence, but it's very good. Sometimes with these concept books, like, oh, here, wouldn't this be a great idea if we did this? Sometimes with those concept books, the concept sounds a lot better than the book actually is. In this case, not so. The book is done really well. The art is really great. And it's just told in really great. The response to it was so good that they decided to keep going with it. I believe originally it was just supposed to be a one-off story, and they decided to do a second series because there was such a great response for it. And again, anyone I've recommended it to has really enjoyed it. Even people who don't normally read graphic novels, as soon as I tell them the concept, they're like, oh, wow, I'd like to read that. And they did, and they liked it. So, Lady Killer, check it out. And that is my top 10.
All right. Well, I think we can now resume GoPro base jumping into dank Brazilian caves.
Let me ask you this, Thomas.
Yeah.
Did you consider how base jumping would translate to the like radio or podcasting? Because I feel like it might not be the best way. It'd just be a lot of wind, I feel like. Wind noises.
Well, my GoPro has this audio-only mode.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess that'll be fine.
And I'm sure the pants-wetting terror of it will translate when I scream.
That's perfect. If anyone is interested in more of our recommendations, Thomas and I do a comics and libraries podcast called Secret Stacks. We do it once a month, and we recommend 3 comics that we've enjoyed that month, every month. So check us out if you want more recommendations.
And you can find us on Twitter at Secret Stacks, and separately as Library Tom and Shiny Info. And yeah. I think we'll also come up if you search our names.
Right. If you want more information about our podcast in general, secretstacks.com basically has everything you're looking for.
And we take questions and feedback, and we'd be happy to talk about maybe titles that would not go on a top 10 list, if you should be so curious.
Oh, yes, indeed. So thank you, Steve, for letting us talk on your podcast, and I hope everyone enjoyed it.
And we look forward to the top 10 of 2016.
Woo! See you later.
See ya.
If you'd like to learn more about the show or listen to past episodes, you can visit circulatingideas.com or follow us on Twitter at CircIdeas. We're also on Tumblr at circulatingideas.tumblr.com, or you can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/circulatingideas. If you have comments, questions, or suggestions for future interviews, you can drop us a line at mail@circulatingideas.com. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening, and keep circulating the ideas.